So anyways, good morning. It is the 24th of February, 2020. It is the 29th of Shvat, Tav Shin Pei. We are up to Musar Day of Perek Yudalid, and here we go. I was actually thinking, now that I'm got a hold of a copy of the Musoris HaRav Chumash, and it looked to me that things were out of order, but now I got it. It rose, the English commentary goes from left to right. Oh, I got it. Okay, so, anyways, so one of the, I'm not so sure about that. All right, anyways, the Pasuk tells us, V'yachalta lifnei Hashem elokecha, this is in, V'yachalta lifnei Hashem elokecha, this is Pasuk Chav Gimel, you will consume in front of Hashem your God, v'makom esher yivchar l'shakein Hashem elosham, ma'iser digancha tirushcha v'yitzarecha, the ma'iser of your dagon and your tirosh and your yitzar, your grain, your wine, your oils, uvchoros bekarcha vitzonecha, and the firstborn of your animals, until madli yaras Hashem elokecha kol yamim, in order to learn, in order to understand and fear Hashem your God all of your days. So that is a important pasuk that is actually and it could add to the importance. And some of the portion pointed this out. It's right after the other rest of the pasukim dealing with what a person is allowed to eat and what a person is not allowed to eat. So the very next section, it seems like it's a totally separate thing. Aser taser, you're going to take meiser. So Rav Soloveitchik points out that it's all going along the same thing. The Rav has a, I don't know if you, Rav Shechter always called it an essay, but it's like a book, called Vikashta Misham. It was, I think, originally published, From There You Shall Seek. I think it was originally published in Yiddish. It was translated over the last couple of years into English. A copy at home. It's pretty dense reading. Even for the Rav standards, it's still pretty dense readings. But he has perhaps one of the more famous sections of Vikashta Misham is going off of this pasuk, where he describes, and this is a concept that we've discussed before, that the V'yachalta lifnei Hashem elokecha, that achila is perhaps the most animalistic thing that a person can do, the thing that a person is sort of, you know, of the very physical trait, that achila is eating. Okay. So eating, the idea of eating is really in order to sustain a person's physicality, okay. Right? That he doesn't discuss it here, but the same concept would exist within the concept of sexuality. And the halachos of the Rambam and his grouping of the laws of food and the laws of sexuality, he puts them in the same section, and that is the halachos, the section called Kedusha. That is the name of the book. The book of Kedusha, which translates as sanctity, the book of sanctity contains the Rambam's laws of that which you're allowed to eat, how you're allowed to shecht meat, and whom you are prohibited from having relations with, including within that are the laws of family purity, etc. So not necessarily the laws of marriage, that's the next book. That's the previous book, I'm sorry. The previous book is the book of Nashim. Those are the laws of marriage and marriage and divorce. And then comes the laws of Kedusha, which deals with who one is prohibited from having relations with. So the Rav writes, the animalistic behavior of eating upon which man's life depends has been refined by the halacha and transformed into a religious ritual and an elevated moral act. A commandment of this sort cannot be understood by Greek moral philosophy. And the Greek moral philosophy, he alludes that, actually. I only brought this in because it has some other sections. But in the actual essay of Vikashta Misham, he seems to constantly be pushing it together or really contrasting with Greek philosophy, which I can't claim to fully understand. But he says, a beast eats, man thinks and cognizes the spiritual in general and the ideal. Meaning, I think what he is saying is that from a Greek perspective, the man's physicality is distinct from his intellect, that the nebuch, man has to eat, but that's really not what he should be focusing on. Really, the ideal is for him to be philosophizing and thinking and pondering and meditating, right? And he sort of just has to eat every once in a while in order to get where you're going. You know, like filling up a car with gas, right? That's not the exciting part of owning a car. That's just like what you have to do in order to be able to drive. So it's the same thing here. So Soloveitchik says that's not the case. That one should and you shall eat before the Lord your God. And this pasuk is the proof of that, right? And you shall eat before the Lord your God. There is a mitzvah to go and eat in Yerushalayim. Can there be two more extreme opposites than these? But it is nevertheless so. The halacha gives priority to eating in the presence of a Kadosh Baruch Hu over tefillah. How do you see that? He says because this whole section is filled with mitzvahs about eating. It's filled with mitzvahs about that. You have to eat this in front of Hashem and eat that in front of Hashem. This you bring to Yerushalayim in order to consume that. All of that is valuing eating. Right? In fact, and there's also a mitzvah of making a bracha every time that one eats. He says, as opposed to tefillah, which we think as the most spiritual of activities, the act of prayer, Rav Soloveitchik says, yeah, it's a machlokas, it's a question whether it's even a biblical mitzvah or not. The Rambam counts it, but others don't. Maybe it's only under certain situations that it's a mitzvah. But why? Because the goal is the act of eating does not represent some mysterious symbolic form of worship. It is in the ordinary thing that man enjoys and with which he satisfies his hunger. On the contrary, if one eats when he's not hungry, so that he's disgusted by the act of eating, he doesn't even fulfill the mitzvah. But the halacha obligates man to eat matzah with an appetite, to eat the korban in a manner of royalty. An animal function can be raised to the level of the original, perfected divine worship. And the same thing with wine. Wine, which could be a symbol of licentiousness and drunkenness and frenzied and idol worship, we transform it into an ideal of how we do mitzvahs. We raise the mundane in order to make it sanctified, which is unique to the Jewish religion, as far as I know. I'm not a religion expert that has studied all of them, but the idea of taking things that are physical and saying that that all of that is contained within our Avodas Hashem, all of that is contained within our worship of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, our worship of God, so that is an amazing thing. And that also doesn't require us to then bifurcate our lives. It doesn't require us to say, well, this is the physical part of my life, and this is the religious part of our life. Rather, every part of one's life becomes the religious part of their life, whether it is, and sometimes even the idea of elevating the physical, as the Rav pointed out, could be even more of a religious growth opportunity than things that are singularly religious in nature. Okay, so that is idea number one that the Rav quoted. There's another interesting idea, a little bit more halachic, but I just saw it here on the page, and it's a fascinating idea, that when it says here, you can eat this in the place, where do you eat it? Where is the requirement to eat? And it's referring specifically to Maaser Sheni. What's Maaser Sheni again? Maaser Sheni is the last tithe that one takes in the Shemitah cycle, in the seven-year cycle, in year one, two, four, and six, you take and you consume it in Yerushalayim. If you can't take it because it's too much, you can redeem it for money and then take the money and spend that in Yerushalayim on things that you would consume and things that you would consume there. Right? So how is it described? You're going to eat it lifnei Hashem Elokecha, in front of Hashem. What does that mean in front of Hashem? What is included in lifnei Hashem? So in this context, lifnei Hashem is referring to within the borders of Yerushalayim. Right, within Yerushalayim. That's what it means to eat lifnei Hashem. Now, lifnei Hashem in other places, however, does not mean in the city of Yerushalayim. What would it mean in front of Hashem in terms of a physical place? Right? If you have to go and do something lifnei Hashem, where would that be? Where might that be? What might that be describing? Yeah. Well, okay, but in terms of a geographical place. Yeah, Zdei Hashem, here saying in this context refers to in the city of Yerushalayim, right? It could also very well mean Lifnei Hashem in the Beis HaMikdash. Right? In the Beis HaMikdash would be the idea of Lifnei Hashem. So he quotes, he's quoting from Grey Matter. Grey Matter is a book put together by someone named Rabbi Chaim Jachter. Chaim Jachter has been a Rebbe for many years at Torah Academy of Bergen County, a very big Talmud Chacham. The Torah Academy of Bergen County is high school in Teaneck. I have a nephew that will be going there next year, Mirza Hashem. So he publishes, I don't know if he still does, but the school used to publish a weekly Dvar Torah bulletin that put in all the shuls, and like three or four the guys in the high school would write a Dvar Torah, and he would write a section on halacha that would take up half the newsletter, a page and a half of halachas. And he collected a lot of those things, put together in a book called Grey Matter. I think there's three or four, maybe even more volumes that are out now. Somebody that I've called with various shilas, he's considered an expert in Erevin. So I've talked with him about our Erev issues that have come up. But wonderful, and it's in English, by the way. If you want like a very solid halachic topic to read through in English. It's not something you sit back on your couch and recline with. It's something you sit at a table and work on, but it is in English and understandable. The book Grey Matter might be for you. So anyways, he says, what about the following? So it seems the term Lifnei Hashem is sometimes used to describe the Beis HaMikdash and sometimes used to describe the city of Yerushalayim. So there was a Shaila that was raised. There is a halacha that when one sees the Beis HaMikdash b'churbano, that one tears kriya, one is supposed to tear their garment. This is a real halacha, often not kept, and often not so easy to be kept, because if somebody goes to the Kotel for the first time in 30 days, not every time you go, but the halacha is for the first time in 30 days, when you go to the Kotel, one is supposed to tear their garment, unless there is an exception to the rule when you wouldn't. So some suggest that if you go on Erev Shabbos, you don't have to. If you go on a day that you don't say Tachnu, you don't have to. It's a big shaila, why or when, etc. But if you go on a regular day, if you would go today to the Kotel for the first time in several months, there would be an obligation to tear one's garment. Now, often people don't do it, plus it looks a little odd, and you don't see other people doing it, but it could very well be because all those other people live there, right, and are going on a regular basis. So, and it's also not so simple, because to tear a garment without a razor or anything like that, without something to start, is not an easy task to do. But that is the halacha. In the past, I've torn it a little bit. You could tear it before you leave. You tear a little bit, and then when you get there, then you could tear the rest of the garment.
What is the symbolic nature of tearing? I mean, that seems like
it's a sign of mourning.
Oh, okay, mourning because you haven't been there.
But no, because of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. You're mourning over the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash.
And that's only if you haven't been there for a while. In other words, once you mourn,
right, so
then you continue.
You get a 30-day reprieve.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
and when it's rebuilt, it's no longer an obligation.
Right, correct. So the halacha is not just that one tears kriya for seeing the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, when also the Gemara tells us with tear kriya for the seeing Yerushalayim b'churbano va'ari Yehuda b'churbano, for seeing the mountains of Yerushalayim. That's what it sounds like, seeing the mountains of Yerushalayim in their destructive state. So you would tear kriya on that as well. You would tear one's garment for that as well. So the question then becomes,
once you tear it, you continue to go, you don't have to tear it until you...
So the halacha sounds like it's a vague issue. Right. Do you tear? Do you tear a little bit more? Are you yotzi with all of them at once? Most would. It sounds like the best thing to do is sort of do it all in one shot and get to the Kotel and then tear kriya, having all in mind. But some raised the question in 1967 when Baruch Hashem. Some raised the question earlier because Ari Yehuda, the mountain surrounding Yerushalayim, began to be rebuilt already earlier. And then when you got to 1967 and the city of Yerushalayim was conquered, or liberated, and now under Jewish control again. And Baruch Hashem, you go to Yerushalayim today, and all you see from the skyline is cranes building, Baruch Hashem, rebuilding Yerushalayim. So is it appropriate to say, Yerushalayim is still in its destructive state? That is the question that was raised. And this question actually impacts many areas of halacha. For example, every Tisha B'Av, it's a shaila, because when you say Nachim, the tefillah in Mincha of Tisha B'Av, there's a tefillah that is added into Shemona Esrei, where in Shemona Esrei we say in Yerushalayim Yerchav Rachamim Tashuv, that's the bracha that we say every day in Shemona Esrei, that in your city Yerushalayim it should be rebuilt, etc. So there's a tefillah called Nachim that gets added in, that we should be consoled over the loss of Yerushalayim, and over the course of that tefillah, here you could see it inside, you say the words Nachim, there. It's added into Yerushalayim Yerchav Rachamim Tashuv, Yerushalayim Yerchav Rachamim Tashuv, Yerushalayim Yerchav Rachamim Tashuv, Yerushalayim should be rebuilt, Chisi David Miral Sochat Tachin, and the throne of David should be established within it. That we say every day. Nothing controversial there. But then you say, Nachim Hashem Elokein, Hashem console as Avei Leit Zion, the mourners of Yerushalayim and the mourners of Yerushalayim, and why? V'yisayir ha'aveilava harivava habzuyava hashomima. The city that is mournful and is ruined and is scored and is desolate, and is havel mibli bana, and it doesn't have his children there. V'chareva mi'avonosel v'abzuyev mikvoda v'ashomimah me'en yoshev, ruined without her abode, scorned without her glory, and desolate without its inhabitants. And it continues on over the course in that way. That sort of recognizing Yerushalayim, that Nevuch Yerushalayim is empty, that there's nobody there. So if you were living in Europe in the if you're living in Vilna in the 1700s, right, and you thought about Yerushalayim on Tisha B'Av, so it makes a lot of sense. Yerushalayim was bereft of Jews. It was to some extent, and even from 1948 to 1967, you could still think about, even though Yerushalayim was Baruch Hashem growing, we didn't have the old city. And you could certainly focus on that there's a major part of Yerushalayim, the central part of Yerushalayim, not geographically, but emotionally, is Judenrein, is absent of Jews. But then, now you, and now it's very hard to say those lines. A, it's somewhat not truthful. And as a couple of years ago, someone spoke in Beth HaMedrash about this halachic topic and said, it's not just not truthful, it lacks Hakar Satov, right? You're lacking thanks to Hashem. I mean, is it really appropriate to say to Hashem, you know, Yerushalayim is desolate when we've had a bracha over the last 50 years is what we've, right? 53 years, right? That was, we celebrated 50 years a couple of years ago, right? We've had 50 years of growth and of beauty and of development and as a fulfillment of the nevuos that we had promised us. So is it appropriate to say that or not? So the same halacha question is raised with, so would you still tear kriya over Yerushalayim? So people are very hesitant to change nischos, to change ways of tefillah. And it's you know, it's an issue. I've never had the guts to say let's go change the words, but it is a challenging thing to say. So is there, what is the case to be made that Yerushalayim is still in a more, that you would still tear kriya over Yerushalayim? So he suggests that that no, it would seem that the obligation, Rabbi Jachter suggests, I think from the Rav, that the obligation to tear upon seeing Jerusalem applies even after 1967. Why? The obligation to tear stems from Yerushalayim's status as an extension of the Beis HaMikdash. As the Mishnah implies, when it talks about the 10 levels of Kedush in Eretz Yisrael, as an expression of the unique holiness of Yerushalayim, it's emanating from the Beis HaMikdash. So one could therefore extrapolate from this Mishnah that Yerushalayim functions as an extension of the Beis HaMikdash. So if the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, Yerushalayim is still considered to be halachically destroyed. That is the case to be made for saying that no, despite the tremendous growth that one sees in the city, that it's still considered destroyed in the absence of a Beis HaMikdash. Now one can make a halachic argument against that and say, yeah, it's true the physical building of the Beis HaMikdash might be destroyed, but the Aron is still there. That's what the Rambam talks about. The Aron is still there. The Kedusha of the Beis HaMikdash, according to most authorities, is still there. So therefore, even though the building isn't built, the rest of Yerushalayim is still built, and the rest of Yerushalayim still has sanctity. The rest of Yerushalayim still has Kedusha, not emanating from the building of the Beis HaMikdash, but emanating from the guts of the Beis HaMikdash, meaning from the Aron itself. So that's a question that is raised. But what?
Is that what does Aron mean?
Aron is the Ark, the Holy Ark.
Okay.
So the halachic tradition, even though I know there are traditions about that it's in Ethiopia or it's in, you know, whatever, but the Rambam writes that that when they foresaw that this, I'm forgetting who Yoshiyahu foresaw that the Beis HaMikdash was going to be destroyed, he built a special compartment within the structure itself, within the Beis HaMikdash itself, and hid the Aron there. And it won't be discovered until the coming of the Beis HaMikdash. There's Gemaras that talk about that people may have found it or tried to find it, etc. But the Aron, our halachic tradition is that the Aron was never found and it's still there. And therefore, the Kedusha, the sanctity emanates from there. That's really the source of Kedusha, the source of sanctity for the Beis HaMikdash. Similar to the source of sanctity in our shuls is the Aron with the Sefer Torah in it.
Where do they believe that it's It is.
Like, it's in there. It's in the compound someplace.
Okay, and we just haven't found it.
Buried in the ground, yeah.
Yeah, but nor do we want to find it.
Well, I mean, the Gemara has stories about people going to find it and they, you know, strange things happen to them, meaning Hashem is not allowing us to find it. Let's put it that way.
We don't go up there.
What?
Which is why we're not allowed to go up there.
What do you mean? Right. The assumption is that I don't want to say we're not allowed to go up there because that's a halachically questionable position. But the reason why it is challenging to go up there is because our assumption is that the Kedusha remains. Yeah.
Is that the Temple Mount?
Yeah, the Temple Mount. Right.
Okay.
They say that it's in the Vatican.
So I don't know if there's really a claim that the Aron's in the Vatican because there was no Aron in the second Beis HaMikdash. The Aron was only in the first Beis HaMikdash. The menorah was in the Vatican. That we know. I mean, on Tisha B'Av, I've told the story in the past. I don't want to go into too much. What?
The Vatican has never returned.
So the question is still there. Some say that it was you know, that when Rome was sacked, it was taken by the Goths and it was moved someplace, whatever. But they definitely have things there. Let's put it that way. I have a testimony that that they definitely have things of ours in the Vatican compound. Yeah.
Okay, so they got into certain areas that aren't open to the public, and you've seen it.
Yeah, there are.
But the second temple used the hidden Aron from the first temple.
So what drove the same thing? What drove the sanctity of the second Beis Hamikdash was the idea that the Aron is embedded within it. Yes.
So therefore, when it's rebuilt the third time, it will still be embedded there and.
Right. Well, yes. I mean, the assumption is that with the coming of Mashiach, we'll be able to then find it. I mean, we'll be able to use. That's what Mel Miller. That was his. That's what his technology was, and able to find gaps underneath the ground. That's how he made all his money. So he developed a way of scanning the ground in order to search for oil. So presumably, if you search for oil, you can also search for an aron. I'll ask him next time I see him. Yes.
You had mentioned about the rebuilding of Yerushalayim.
Yes.
Is there a zoning?
I believe so. I that's not a halachic issue. That is a Yerushalayim issue.
The color of stone has to match, so at sunset it looks golden, kind of the lime.
Yeah, that's the way they do things. So they they've been able to, there's also an idea of using stone from Yerushalayim for the building of shuls today, which is that's sort of there is it's not just a nice thing to put Jerusalem stone in shuls. There actually is some halachic value in doing that. I think we gave a halacha day on that here. I think it's on YU Torah about the topic of using a dirt or stones from Israel to build shuls and chutz la'aretz, whether that's a good idea or a bad idea. Okay, so one other, so also famous from this pasuk of Aser Taser, is from here we learn the idea of giving tzedakah, or giving, is the basis for, the Gemara uses it as the basis for the idea of taking Meiser Ksafim, taking one-tenth of one's earnings and donating that should be the minimal amount that a person gives to tzedakah. So I chose at least not to do that for halacha day. We did something else, but there's many halachas about that. I gave shirim also earlier this year. We went with the stuck on the Monday night Shulchan Aruch shir, so we have one or two shirim on that topic. But I just want to bring your attention to one issue, and that is the Gemara says, Aser Taser, take off Meiser, so that you will become rich, so that you will become wealthy. That's what the Gemara spells that. So it's not clear what the Gemara is referring to. Could be referring to Meiser Ksafim, the one-tenth. And that's the basis. You may have heard the idea that, if you give tzedakah, you automatically get it back. It's based on that Gemara. So not all Meforshim agree that that's necessarily what the Gemara meant, that it's referring to, anytime you give tzedakah, you're promised that you're going to get it back. It could refer specifically to Meiser. It could be referring to specifically to this Meiser, to Meiser Ani, which is being described here in this portion here. Rav Soloveitchik said, and I was always bothered by, how do you ever know? The way it's sort of told over is, you have a permission to test Hashem and say, I'm giving this money and I expect to get it back. Right? So there is a Seinfeld episode where Kramer called Seinfeld Even Steven. He says, you're Even Steven. Everything you get comes back. He says, give me $20. Jerry gives him $20 and Kramer takes and throws it out the window and says, don't worry, you'll get it back. And truth is, now I'm forgetting what happened. I think like George came in like, I found $20 on the street. So, so there is a concept though that the Gemara tells the Maseches Rosh Hashanah that. So I always wondered, how do you have that works? I mean, how do you know? Right, so I give tzedakah, and I expect to get the $50 I gave for tzedakah back. So that mean that a call is going to come in and order 15 mezuzahs for me. But then how do I know that that's the makeup for the tzedakah? Maybe it's just because it's part of my preordained earnings from the beginning of the year, right? How is one supposed to cheshbon that out? So the Gemara tells us that gimel dvar maskir avonosov shel adam, that there is three things that recall the sins of a person, and one of them, the Gemara says, is iyun tefila. Iyun tefillah. What does iyun tefillah mean? It literally means investigating tefillah. That doesn't sound like a very bad thing at all. So Tosfos explains that that means that when you daven, you expect that it's going to happen. That you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to ask for things to happen, but not expect for them to happen. That's inappropriate. Except for in one area where you're allowed, and therefore you're not supposed to say, on behalf of this tefillah, please do this for me. Right? That's, you're allowed to sort of, it's a very nuanced thing here. You're allowed to ask for things, but it's not supposed to be, because I daven, you should therefore do this for me. Right? The only time you're allowed to make that request, however, is by tzedakah. Then when it comes to tzedakah, a person is allowed to give tzedakah and say, I'm giving tzedakah, and in the merit of the tzedakah, do this for me. Right? You're allowed to do this. So Rav Soloveitchik said that only applies to tzedakah and no other halachas. You're allowed to, and that's where the source for our custom is of when we do Misha Berach. So when we say, oh, Misha Berach, whoever blessed Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov should also give you a bracha. Bavur, why? So Rav Soloveitchik was very careful that he felt it shouldn't be bavur that I got an aliyah to the Torah. Right, I should get a bracha because I got an aliyah. So that's inappropriate. The only thing you could do that for is I should get a bracha because I gave tzedakah. That's the only time you're allowed to do it. And he goes and tells the story that one time Rav Soloveitchik got an aliyah, like on a Thursday morning, and whoever the gabbai was in that minyan was so excited that Rav Soloveitchik was there, so they gave him the minyan, gave him the aliyah, and said, oh, I'm going to give you a Misha Berach as well. So he gives him a Misha Berach, and Rav Soloveitchik said, I need to give money for this. Right, it's only bavur, right? Bavur, I have to give money. But the guy wasn't expecting this at all. So bavur, then I'm going to give tzedakah. And then the guy wanted to give him another Misha Berach for some reason. And Rav Soloveitchik, well, I guess I got to give you more money then, right? And continued along those lines. That is an interesting approach here. I would add in, we have 1 minute left. And just, there is in the Chafetz Chaim Al HaTorah, so that was put together by Rav Shmuel Greineman. So I assume, I'm not really sure who helped put this together. I actually got this from the Loves Raymond collection when he left town. He asked that I take some of his farm, so I happily obliged. So in the Chafetz Chaim Al HaTorah, so he quotes some of the ideas about a person who gives that a person who doesn't give enough tzedakah. So there are some questionable things that will happen to him. The Gemara spells out a certain story of a woman who, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, this is Gemara in Ksuvis, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai came and found this woman. And he said, what are you doing here? She said, oh, I'm collecting barley grains from the dung of the animals. And she was so poor, so she said, well, who are you? And she said, I'm the daughter of Naktimon ben Gurion. And he said, Nachim Aguri, he was the most wealthiest person in town. He was one of the people that when they had the siege of Yerushalayim, he offered to provide the entire city of Yerushalayim with food from his storehouses and would have been able to help them for 21 years or something like that. So what happened? So the Gemara gives a story about how he didn't give enough tzedakah. And the Gemara says, what do you mean? He did give plenty of tzedakah. He said, apparently he didn't give enough. So he tells in a footnote here, which I assume is from Shmuel Greineman, he says, "Upam hafach b'schusim shel ashirim she'in mafrishim mehunim karoi." That sometimes ashirim, wealthy people, will lose their wealth because they didn't give enough appropriately. And he says, for example, one time we saw in the city of Vilna that a shikar, a drunk person, fell asleep on the sidewalk someplace, and all the children were making fun of him. So one person went by and he said to the drunk person, as a joke, Pavas Tsuchok, Al Svasav, Adam Shekmosa, someone like you, it's too bad, Chaval Sheina Tayudeya Mashikrus Osa. It's too bad that you don't realize what drunkenness does. Because if I would get drunk, I would at least know better than to fall asleep on the sidewalk because everyone makes fun of me. Right? So he continues on and says, so too, that people walk around and they talk about the wealthy people. Oh, if only I was that wealthy, so I would give a lot of tzedakah. But, that wealthy guy doesn't give, but if I was wealthy, I would give. So he says, and then they forget, because then they get a little bit of money, and they keep on coming up with excuses as to why they continue to not give money. That it's easy to judge people in other situations, but and then to come with excuses when you yourself are in that situation. So A, it's a general piece of mussar, in general piece of life, but in specifically in the area of tzedakah, to keep in mind that as a person grows and perhaps gets additional earnings, that Kadosh Baruch Hu is kind to them to make sure that their tzedakah giving work goes in accordance with his earnings. There's other stuff to say, but maybe we'll actually just give one more. Just because it's in our everyday tefillah, he says also that a person, we have an idea that a person sometimes there might have been a gezeira on a person that they should die. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu in his rachamim says, I'm going to just make you poor. That was an ani chashuv kameis. A poor person is considered like a dead person, like the story with Yaakov, that Yaakov had all his money taken from him, and therefore he considered he was an ani. So then he says, and that's the explanation of the pasuk, Arumimcha Hashem kidili sani. This is in our daily tefillah, Mizmor Shir, Chanukah Sabayis L'David, Arumimcha Hashem kidili sani. That I praise Hashem, so the way you see it translated in the Siddur is because he drew me up. But some suggest that it comes from the word dal, that he pushed me down, that I praise Hashem for making me poor. Why? Because by making me poor, so Hashem has, I was able to avoid the death sentence. I mean, I was made poor instead of that, and that gives me the ability to eventually be able to be drawn up as again. And v'lo samachta oivayli is the end of the pasuk, and my enemies were not able to rejoice, meaning the satan and the malcham aves. Because I still have the opportunity to be able to grow and do tshuva, and the end has not come. Okay, so there's much more to talk about, of course, this parak. Stop here. This Hashem pick up tomorrow. I think. Hopefully tomorrow with the next parak.
So just